All right, we have everybody here. Judge Welch, okay, you just unmuted. So good morning and welcome to the June 9, 2020, 9:30 a.m. WebEx oral argument for the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm Rico Bishop, and I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Mike Pirtle and Judge Larry Welch. And the case we have for this 9:30 session is Walters versus Frakes. Mr. Arney, you'd like to proceed? We're going to proceed just as we would if you were in the courtroom. If you have your screen adjusted so you can see the clock, it should be in an equally sized grid. Then you'll be able to watch your time that way. All right?
Okay. Yes, I can see it. Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
We can't.
Okay, yes. Great.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. If it pleases the court, counsel, thank you for the opportunity to be heard here. Certainly, I know the court wanted to address issues of jurisdiction, so if at any point the court has questions about jurisdiction, certainly please feel free to ask questions. I believe I'm prepared to respond to those. The underlying case is interesting in the sense that the argument on appeal, notwithstanding the jurisdictional questions, is whether the trial court was clearly wrong in reaching its holding that Mr. Walters did not put the state on sufficient notice to trigger the state's duty to start providing medical care to Mr. Walters. And as argued in the appeal, or excuse me, in the brief, under both an objective and a subjective lens, there's really no rational basis for the court to have reached its conclusion, and the court was clearly wrong. It's very well.
Can we go ahead and just jump to that jurisdiction issue?
Absolutely, Judge. It looks like you're going to ask a question, so let's kind of trying to delay things while you're formulating.
Yeah. Go ahead. So, I mean, I see that in the joint pretrial memo that was filed March 29, 2019, that sovereign immunity is struck out in the joint pretrial memo. And it's initialed by both the trial attorneys at that time. And, you know, I do think the Davis versus State case came after this complaint was initially filed. By my notes, it looks like the complaint was filed in July 2017. Davis versus State came out in about October of 2017. So it's unclear what may have happened to cause the state to strike or agree to strike sovereign immunity defense. And I don't know if you can shed light on that.
Your Honor, as the appellant's counsel, I'm not sure exactly strategically what the state wanted to do there. If I remember right, it's been a couple of years ago, I was somewhat confused as to why they would waive any particular defense like that. But of course, counsel for the appellee may have more insight on that. With respect to what I saw in the Davis case and your questions of jurisdiction, I think as long as the appellant or plaintiff at the time pleads something which is facially meets the types of claims that are acceptable under the State Tort Claims Act, then we get to litigate the facts. With respect to qualified immunity, the only remaining defendant is actually the department. Working on this here, I'm reviewing back through the procedural history of the case. And I noted that the federal court dismissed Mr. Frakes as an individual in March of 2018, I believe. So the only remaining defendant is the actual state, the Department of Corrections, and I believe we met the condition precedent to filing the lawsuit, and that we filed the tort claim in a timely fashion.
Okay, so can I take an opportunity here and walk you down a line here, and I can more specifically point you to our jurisdictional concern, okay?
Thank you.
So you acknowledge that it's a tort suit against a state agency, so the State Tort Claims Act applies, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then in your brief, you speak to the Rush versus Wilder case, Supreme Court case, as it relates to perhaps the correction, Department of Corrections duty, and that perhaps it can be derived from that case. However, that case is a Section 1983 case governing in an Eighth Amendment constitutional violation with respect to notions of deliberate indifference. So the question then becomes, well, this is not a deliberate indifference claim. It was a negligence claim and ordinary care. So in trying to derive what the duty would be, we have to look and determine what that duty would be. So my question to you then, as it relates then ultimately to jurisdictional concerns and the notion of discretionary function, is what is the statutory or regulatory basis here for the Department of Corrections with respect to your client, so that we can examine the notion of discretionary function to determine whether or not there is jurisdiction here. Does that make sense?
I believe so, Your Honor. Hopefully my answer will indicate that I understand the question. The violation here is, I guess, corrections officer or sergeant at the time he testified, Alexander Hagen, laid out the obligation, what was violated. And it's not a discretionary function to provide medical care to an inmate. It's a mandatory obligation. The question is whether the duty was triggered. Now, is it discretionary for a corrections employee to determine whether to engage in to act on an inmate's request for medical care? And Mr. Hagen, his testimony essentially identified that the answer is no, it's not discretionary. Even minimal complaints of medical problems trigger the correctional officers or the employees' duty to further inquire as to the nature of the problem. The trial court's holding was that Mr. Walters was too vague in his descriptions. But under the Estelle case, the obligation to provide medical care is not discretionary. And then when you kind of dovetail that with the exception to the due care exception to the what is the State Tort Claims Act prohibits suits that are based on claims that with respect to an employee acting with due care. And if there was due care exercised, then the trial court does not have jurisdiction to address the claim. Problem is
So let me interrupt you again for 1 second. So in this particular case, as I look at the pleading and ultimately the record, it wasn't that your client didn't receive medical care. He did. It was the timeliness of the receipt of that care in relation to having placed him on notice of a need. And so in that regard, we have to identify what that duty is, what the statutory basis is, to see whether or not there was a violation in relation to the discretionary function exception. And right. So in that regard, I mean, what I found, I was looking for the statute or regulation that perhaps would set forth that duty. I found in 83-181, it provides each person committed to the Department of Correctional Services shall have medical and dental care. And then it goes on as to other specific requirements. It's a very broad-based statement. I couldn't find any other regulation in that regard. So if that is the statute that sets forth the duty, then we have to examine that two-part step or that two-step analysis the Supreme Court has set out for us in connection with, in relation to that, is that discretionary? Does that give room for discretion in that staff's decision with respect to the nature of that report and when to deliver that care? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And the answer is no. The staff member does not have discretion. Alexander Hagen, testified that the threshold to trigger their obligation to react is extraordinarily low. If an inmate complains of a medical problem, there's a duty to to, at a minimum, further inquire into the nature of the medical problem. Now, the question about whether the staff member has an obligation to then do anything, perhaps is maybe, not conceding it, but maybe discretionary. But there was nothing even done in this case. The you know, Mr. Hagan's testimony clearly established that, even based on his own interaction with Mr. Walters previously, something more should have been done. It was not a discretionary function for the corrections officer to exercise medical judgment. It was not a discretionary function of the corrections officer to go alert medical. That is their obligation. It's not a discretion.
Is it their obligation, no matter what the inmate is telling them is the problem? I mean, if an inmate says, my hand hurts, my head hurts, you know, my leg has a cramp, isn't there some measure of discretion that will need to be exercised?
When it comes to an inmate's medical care, no, I don't believe there is some measure of discretion. There's at a minimum an obligation to ask some follow-up questions. And that was seemingly not done here. There's not discretion for a corrections officer to exercise medical judgment. Right? That discretion, if it exists, lies at the level of the nurse over in the medical unit. And eventually, in this particular case, obviously, the nurse was alerted. Now, we have concerns about the amount of detail that was provided to the nurse, but you know, that's really not the issue here, because by that point, for a couple reasons. One, by that point, it was too late. Number two, that would be the exercise of a discretionary function. But alerting medical in the first place, asking some follow-up questions, that's not a discretionary function. Mr. Hagan clearly identifies that as something that absolutely should have been done. It's not the corrections officer's obligation to make medical decisions. Now, if to address your specific question, Your Honor, someone's complaining of a hangnail or something like that, you know, I would argue that's not even a medical complaint. But when an actual subjectively and even objectively clear medical complaint is being made, the corrections officers do not have discretion to exercise medical judgment. Their obligation is to go talk to medical and let medical exercise the discretionary judgment. They could look at it reasonably and be wrong, but that's where the obligation is.
Thank you, Ms. Rennie. I see you're out of time. So we'll
thank
go
you
ahead.
For letting me go over.
Sure. All right, Mr. Smith, and you are still muted, it looks like. There we go.
Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Yes. Okay, thank you. May it please the court, I'm going to go and discuss the subject matter jurisdiction issue exclusively, unless the court leads me elsewhere. The trial court in this case had no jurisdiction, and thus this court has no jurisdiction under the State Tort Claims Act to adjudicate the plaintiff's complaint for two independent reasons. First, the complaint on its face shows that the state defendants could not have committed the alleged tortious acts as private individuals. And second, the complaint on its face shows that it is barred by the discretionary function exception of the State Tort Claims Act. As far as the joint trial memo, I think it's just basic law that parties can't stipulate or agree to subject matter or jurisdiction. And the Davis case said that when a complaint shows on its face that a claim is barred by the State Torts Claim Act, the state's inherent immunity from suit is a jurisdictional issue that an appellate court cannot ignore.
Mr. Smith, that was not raised at the trial level, is that correct?
That is correct. In fact, it wasn't even raised in my brief. I would concede that
was my next question. So are you saying this is a plain error review for us then?
It's a sua sponte review in which under the Davis case, he still had a duty as the plaintiff to allege on his complaint on his face that state tort claim immunity did not apply. So I think it's a de novo look at the allegations of the complaint to see if he has alleged that he's excluded or he can file suit under the State Tort Claims Act and the exceptions don't apply. The first point that I made is the State Tort Claims Act allows liability against the state only to the extent that the Claims Act allows. Section 81-8,210(4) defines a tort claim as being a claim caused by negligent conduct of a state official, quote, under circumstances in which the state, if a private person, would be liable to the claimant for damages. And in Davis, they also, one of the holdings of that case is they acknowledge that the state defendants could not have committed the tortious acts set out in the complaint as private individuals because the nature of the conduct alleged, in which was alleged, plaintiff made the allegations, that could not be committed by private individuals. It's interesting, the complaint, the plaintiff could allege any number of things, but his complaint alleged a duty to provide medical care to the plaintiff inmate when they failed to use care under like circumstances, quote, by other corrections departments engaged in similar care of similar inmates. Other corrections departments are not private individuals, they're government. And because he went and alleged the complaint that way, he necessarily took himself out of the Tort Claims Act for being able to sue private individuals because he's claiming a duty of departments, other corrections departments engaged in similar care. That's government, that's not private individuals. So on its face right there, he filed a complaint that took him out of the State Tort Claims Act. As far as his allegations were limited for negligence. They were all allegations of immediate notification by basically prison staff to the medical staff. As I read it, he's not complaining about the actual medical care he got. He alleged negligence in defendant staff not immediately informing prison medical staff. And that gets into the discretionary function exception. It's a two-step analysis. First, the court must consider whether the action involves an element of judgment. And I would say that when an inmate is telling a staff person vaguely, as he alleged, alleged a condition, then it comes down to where's the duty that of immediate notification to medical staff. It's my position would be it is necessarily a matter of judgment. You're in a prison. It's a matter of judgment when you're telling guards, jailers, things about medical, your medical condition as to the immediate notification element is what he alleged as being the duty.
Mr. Smith.
He doesn't allege anything as far as there is some administrative policy that certain medical conditions, such as an erection that has not been dissipated, must be reported immediately. It's necessarily thus falls into the matter of discretion of when to notify medical staff. And so to me, it's a matter of carrying out that policy of how and when is medical care to be carried out by statute. And he doesn't allege that there is somehow some duty of immediate notification. In fact, if you go beyond face of the complaint, the testimony he presented by the prison official was that if guards immediately notified all medical staff of everyone's condition, it would simply overwhelm the system. So I think it comes down to matter of judgment as to what he is telling someone, or does the duty arise of immediate notification? And frankly,
can I interrupt you for a second?
So please do.
I had quoted 83-181 as perhaps the proper statute as it relates to the basic analysis here. Would you agree with that, or is there something else you could offer me in that regard?
No, I would agree that's the basic statute, and it's an overall duty to provide medical care. Then I would submit it's a matter of policy of the Department of Corrections as to how that care is then administered. Obviously, in the context of the way he's alleged that the care is administered by inmates communicating to other staff who then communicate to the medical staff, and the communication then it becomes a matter of policy and judgment once you notify other staff as to how they then notify the medical staff. But he's just making a general allegation of a requirement to immediately notify of a medical condition. And to me, that's a matter of department policy of guards in their judgment get notice from inmates and then how that gets communicated to the medical staff. But it's not, you just don't have doctors standing outside everyone's cell to analyze them. It's necessarily a system in which there's judgment involved. Judgment involves notifying medical staff depending upon the condition, emergency nature of the commission condition. He doesn't allege that he ever gave that notification.
I'd like to, I appreciate all the discussion on discretionary function, but I'd like to talk a little bit about how we can get there. And I understand that as a court, we can sua sponte and have to really deal with subject matter jurisdiction, which in the current state of the law, we would get to discretionary function, but this has kind of got a unique twist to it, you know, in that when the complaint was filed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I could not file an answer from the state in our record. And so at the time the complaint was filed, under the state of the law at that time, the state had to affirmatively plead sovereign immunity and the discretionary exception at that time, or it was deemed waived. And then the Supreme Court subsequently then in October of 2017, the complaint was filed in July of 2017, the Supreme Court comes out with Davis. And they say, oh, we've reconsidered our past cases. It was a mistake to say that the state had to affirmatively plead this. And so, you know, we're reversing that line of thinking and now saying that it's always a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. So I understand the current state of the law, but at the time, I mean, is there an answer in our record that shows us whether the state even pled sovereign immunity?
I should know, but I have to confess, I don't know if the transcript does contain an answer. And I'm out of time. If I may proceed, just to answer the question. Okay. I think it comes down to is the court's Davis decision, is that a matter of procedure? Is it a matter of substance? If it's a matter of substantive law, then it does apply. I don't know if the court wants to ask for supplemental briefing on the issue. I'd be happy to do so. I would, if I can point out what Davis does have an interesting discussion. In which it, the quote is, most federal circuits have held that the plaintiff bears the burden of alleging facts that show the exceptions to the government's waiver immunity under the Federal Tort Claims Act do not deprive the court of subject matter of jurisdiction. Now, Davis points out most federal circuits have held that. Davis did not specifically say we similarly hold that, but taking the court's Supreme Court's rationale, they overrule its prior precedent because it's not inconsistent with federal court decisions. Thus, I guess the part that I quoted out of Davis is that part of the holding of the case, that since federal courts say that the plaintiff bears the burden of alleging facts to show subject matter jurisdiction, if he hasn't done so, then that burden remains on him and the court can dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Is that procedural? Is it substantive? I guess I find it hard to conclude that something that involves subject matter jurisdiction is simply procedural, but it maybe it's an issue that would require some further research.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue for sure, because I mean, and I'm perplexed a little bit by the fact that we have this joint pretrial memo where sovereign immunity is specific, it's scratched out. I mean, you know, there's lines drawn through it, and it makes me suspect, which I know we can't speculate, but did the state not affirmatively plead it? And at that time it was deemed waived. And so there was then some kind of acknowledgement agreement that we can't try that issue or we can't address that issue anymore. I don't know. But I am troubled by it. I do think it comes down then to a matter of whether it was a procedural or substantive change, and that is maybe something we need to evaluate further.
Yeah, if I could, one thing just to point out to the court, I think may be helpful. There is a case that's been submitted to the Nebraska Supreme Court. It's been argued, brief, submitted. It does involve the trial court dismissing a complaint on the face under the discretionary function exception. It's the case by the state of the inmate who was murdered by his cellmate. And the complaint concerns the department having housed the inmates together, which then raised the discretionary function exception. The district court dismissed. It's been briefed, argued to the Supreme Court, so it was a dismissal on the face on the discretionary function exception. I don't know if the court's aware of it. My recollection, it's Moser v. State. I can get the site to the court if it would like, but I know that case is in the works and there's going to be an opinion coming out at some point that may be helpful to the court.
Thank you for that. We've gone over a bit. Mr. Arney, if you'd like to have a few final words here in light of this discussion on the subject matter jurisdiction, please go ahead. You're still muted.
Okay. Can you...
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Briefly, perhaps there is a discretionary function in determining whether there is a medical emergency. If, for example, an inmate says, you know, CO, I've got a hangnail, please contact medical. I would not disagree with the suggestion that whether medical should be contacted at that point or not is a discretionary function of the guard. But when there's, you know, objectively a medical emergency identified, at that point, the corrections officer does not have discretion to determine what medical care the inmate receives or when the inmate receives the medical care or how it is administered. You know, that guard's duty at that point is to contact the, in this case, the prison medical unit for further direction. Now at that point, once the nurse gets the information, then the nurse has the authority to assess the information and exercise his or her own judgment. But once an objectively, you know, clear medical emergency is identified, and in this case, in the context of what Mr. Walters was discussing, I think the only conclusion is that he objectively identified there was some kind of medical emergency going on. And at that point, the officer no longer had discretion to contact medical. In fact, the officer said they would, or the employees, one was a case manager, I think, in fact, said they would contact medical. It was not discretionary at that point. It was mandatory for them to contact the medical unit and then let the medical unit exercise whatever discretion they wish to exercise.
So is it your position that... we can go ahead and address the discretionary function exception and that the current state of the law should apply to this case, even though it was not the state of the law at the time this case was filed.
Well, I think if the fact that it wasn't the state of the law at the time the case was filed, you know, means the way that it should be analyzed is under the way it was at the time. If the court's going to, you know, look at it as a, you know, strictly a jurisdictional question, and certainly I understand if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, there's no subject matter jurisdiction. I think questions of affirmative defenses or how it's pled, if there's no affirmative, sorry, if there's no subject matter jurisdiction are irrelevant. But if the court is going to look at it under the current state of the law, the discretionary function may have already been, you know, exercised when determining whether there's a medical emergency or not. Once it's identified, there's no longer the discretion. As for whether the current state of the law should be used or whether what it was when the case was filed, I'm not necessarily prepared to address that particular issue. If the court wants further briefing, I could do that.
Yeah, would you both be willing to submit a supplemental brief just specific to this issue of subject matter jurisdiction and the unique situation we find ourselves in this case, where when the complaint was filed, Davis had not yet been decided. And so how that may have impacted what happened, what transpired before Davis came out. Is there anything else, Judge Welch or Judge Pirtle, anything else specific that you would like them to address in that of that nature?
Not for me.
That'll capture it for me. Thank you.
Yep.
Right. So,
Your Honor, assuming I'm not on mute, I'm happy to do supplemental brief. The only thing I would say is what my scheduling is. I would hope the court would give me at least 3 weeks to do that, because a brief's not going to do you any good if it's really not comprehensive enough. The other thing I would point out is if the case is, you're going to ask for supplemental briefing and the case is not then deemed submitted, I think I should, under the rules, be allowed to, and both parties should be allowed to submit a supplemental transcript. I believe I can provide a supplemental transcript that would show that the state did file an answer. The answer was filed in federal court upon the transfer, but then that pleading would follow when it was remanded to state court. And so I would be able to at least file a supplemental transcript showing what that pleading was, which I think would be helpful to the court also.
Do you have any objection to that, Mr. Arney?
No, I don't. Just for the record, it looks like it was filed August 7, 2017.
But I don't believe it's contained in our record. So I do think it makes sense if we can have the record supplemented, that would be helpful. So this is kind of an interesting situation, and I think we can kind of proceed as we wish and how we do this. But my sense is that really the state should maybe submit the first brief in support. Would you disagree with that, Mr. Smith?
I don't disagree. I don't have any objection to whatever way the court wants to proceed, just to make a decision.
I think that might be helpful since it really is a position that would favor the state here, and we're raising this sua sponte. So I think if you would address the brief first, and if you need 3 or 4 weeks even, I mean, would 4 weeks be better for you?
A month. What I've got a U.S. Supreme Court brief due on July 6th. So yeah, that would be helpful.
So how about if we have your brief due, you tell me, you have a calendar, you tell me. 4 weeks.
Best case scenario for me would be July 13th.
Would be what?
That would give me a week after I have to finish my brief with the U.S. Supreme Court.
July 13th?
Yes.
All right. Let's make it July 13th. And how many weeks after that would you like, Mr. Arnie?
Oh, if I could have 30 days, that would be fine. So four weeks.
So we'll have your brief due August 10th.
Okay.
Monday. And the supplemental transcript, just please get filed before your brief is due, obviously, Mr. Smith. And anything else from Judge Welch or Judge Pirtle that you would want to add to that?
Not for me.
And not for me, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much. I know this is a little unusual, but I do think it's a very interesting issue in light of the change by Davis versus State and how we can or should apply that case now, given that it wasn't really something addressed by the parties from the get-go. So thank you. I appreciate that. We'll look forward to seeing your briefing. Thanks for joining us this way by WebEx and for taking the extra steps necessary to do that. It's much appreciated. So thank you very much. And unless there's further questions, we'll adjourn and the case will be held for submission until after Mr. Arney's brief is filed. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Good day.
You too.